text in 2 Samuel. We've left David at a crisis moment. He's returning to Jerusalem, but he's not returning in the greatest security of his throne. Because as he was coming up to Jerusalem from Gilgal, let me zoom in on this area so you can see it. So here's Gilgal, where they were marching up from the Jordan River. And when we say up, in our American mentality, we're always right, right? America. We're the reference point of the world. That's why we love maps with us in the middle and Asia split down in half on each side of the map. That's the way it should be, right? But this confused the daylights out of me for a while, because they would talk about going up to Jerusalem when they're clearly heading south. And I said, oh, that's not up. Up is north. Let me get my bearings here. That way. I was telling Kim, I don't know what it is about inside this building is like the Bermuda Triangle for me. I usually have a pretty good sense of direction, but when I'm standing inside these walls, I can never pick out which way is north. I almost always flip it. But up is in reference to altitude. So if you're climbing up in elevation, you're going up. If you're going down in elevation, you're going down. That makes sense, doesn't it? Except to us Americans who say, if I'm going up to Rockford or I'm going down to Peoria, and you don't go down to Peoria because that's south. You go up to Rockford because you're going up north. This was fun when we moved to West Virginia. They referenced everything by the flow of the river, which is altitude as well. But I would always tell the people, so I'm going down to Charleston, and they would look, or going up to Charleston because Charleston was north of where we lived. And they would look at me funny and they'd say, no, you mean down to Charleston. I'd say, no, Charleston's north of here. And they say, you're following the river downstream. You're going down to Charleston. And so bitter feuds over that. You know. But, you know, when in Rome, do as the Romans. So I slowly tried to conform myself to it. So when you're reading Scripture, if they ever do talk about going up, it means they're ascending in elevation. So you start down here at the Jordan River, which is one of the lowest points on earth. The Dead Sea right here is somewhere around 1,500 feet below sea level. So it's one of the lowest places on earth. It's very hot. I think the day I went to visit down there at the Dead Sea, it was about 125 degrees, somewhere around there. So you stand down there and sweat buckets, but you never get wet. I mean, it just evaporates. There's like steam coming off of everybody all the time. And then you go swim in that nasty water. And everybody thinks it's just this great thing. You can float in the Dead Sea because it's so saline. I think it's somewhere around 3.5 times the level of salt that the ocean has in the Dead Sea, because the Dead Sea, there's no longer any fresh water coming into it. It's just evaporating, and all those minerals are getting denser and denser in that water. And so they tell you it's good to float in it. It's like mineral springs or something. I reached down, felt it, and it honestly felt like I was sticking my hands in 10W-40 mortar oil. It was so thick and slimy. I said, I am not getting in that water. That's nasty. So I forewent it. I just stood on the beach and took pictures of everybody else having fun swimming in the Dead Sea. So anyhow, you're very low in elevation here at the Jordan River, and they crossed the Jordan. David ascended up towards Gilgal as the road goes. Jericho and Gilgal here very close together, and then you would continue the ascent westward up the mountains to Jerusalem. And along the way, he ran into some trouble because there was a dispute between the members of the northern tribes of Israel and the southern tribe of Judah. The northern tribes were jealous that Judah got there first and had that place of honor. And the tribe of Judah continued to say, hey, we didn't mean anything by it. We just got here first. You should have sped up if you really wanted to be here first. And so it erupted into a big feud until finally one man who is named as a worthless person, or literally translated as a son of Belial, chapter 20, verse 1. There happened to be there a worthless man, a son of Belial, whose name was Sheba, the son of Bichri, a Benjaminite. And he blew a trumpet and said, we have no portion in David, we have no inheritance in the son of Jesse. Every man to his tents, O Israel. That is a formal declaration of independence. That's a formal declaration. We no longer are going to serve King David. We're not going to recognize him as our king anymore. What was the response of Britain to the 13 colonies upon signing that document? War. Oh yeah, you think you're independent? You know, so there's that big question. When did America gain its independence? Was it on July 4th when we ratified the Declaration? Or was it sometime in 1783 when the British finally surrendered and stopped fighting us? Well, we're Americans, so we look at things from our standpoint. Boy, it's when we said we were independent. That's when we became independent, right? Don't you tell me otherwise. And so this man declares independence, and everybody disperses except for Judah and David's men, and they ascend up to Jerusalem. Well, David wants to replace Joab as commander of the army, and he's going to replace him with Amasa. Now, we can debate about the politics of that maneuver. Probably was not a great maneuver, seeing that Amasa was aligned with Absalom during his rebellion. So, you know, you're just newly come back to the throne, trying to reestablish your power, and you're going to appoint a guy who was associated with the most recent rebellion. Probably not a great idea, right? But anyway, that's what David decided to do. Well, Joab had some issues with that and eventually murdered Amasa while they were trying to gather the troops in order to go after Sheba. Joab murders Amasa right in front of everybody, runs him through with his sword, spills all his innards out upon the ground, and sorry for those of weak constitution, but there's the description. And so in front of all the troops, in front of all the commanders, Joab murders this man. Takes him by the beard as if to kiss him, and then kills him. Well, then Joab takes command of the army de facto and is going to put down Sheba's rebellion. At the very least, we can say for Joab, he at least has the idea he wants to reestablish David's authority over Israel. Joab's not the greatest guy in the history of the Scriptures. He's a murderer, he's pretty self-serving, but he does at least continually consider what's going to be in David's best interest, and at least politically speaking. We'll put it that way, we'll put a limit on it. He's a keen politician, he knows what's going to be politically best for David, and even when David doesn't want it, Joab forces the situation, so we'll at least give him that, but he is a violent guy. And so that brings us up to speed to verse 14, because Joab now has the armies amassed here at Gibeah, or the stone that's at Gibeon, which is where he killed Amasa. So we are about 10 miles northwest of Jerusalem. If you can see the little hand moving up here on the screen, this is Gibeon. And this is where the armies have gathered. But now they have a problem. They got to find Sheba. And so it's going to take them a little while, and that's where we pick up in verse 14. Sheba passed through all the tribes of Israel to Abel of Beth-Maacah, and all the Bichrites assembled and followed him in. So Sheba is the son of Bichri, so all the Bichrites would be the family. So it would be akin to saying that Jim, the son of Polly, which I know your dad's name wasn't Polly, right? But we'll just call you Polly. Jim, the son of Polly, and all the Pollyites assembled at their house. So that's the way to reference the family. We use family names, surnames. They didn't have them. And so Sheba, the son of Bichri, would have been in the Bichrite family. And so when he goes up to this town of Abel, Beth-Maacah, and all the Bichrites go with him, that's his family. His near kin have come up there. We don't know how many of them there are, but they have all assembled with him at Abel of Beth-Maacah. And we're in verse 14 of 2 Samuel chapter 20. Excuse me for just a second here. Okay. Abel Beth-Maacah is in the extreme north of Israel. So I'm going to scroll up on our map here so you can see this. I'm going to zoom out first of all, and then we're going to scroll up north. So right down here amidst all these names that's kind of hard to see, here's Jerusalem, and here is Gibeon, and way up north, you got to travel through Ephraim, up here through Naphtali, this area that in the New Testament's called Galilee. Here's the Sea of Galilee. You've got to go north above that. Up here's this little town of Dan. This is the extreme north of the borders of Israel. Dan, if you see references in Scripture, it says from Dan to Beersheba. Dan's in the uttermost north, Beersheba's the southern border. So you're talking about Israel from north to south, from Dan to Beersheba. Go ahead, Gene.
Is that where the tribe of Dan was?
It is, yes. They originally were farther south. And in the book of Judges, they ran out of room for themselves. They expanded and filled all the territory that had been allotted for them. So a small contingent of them went farther north and gained, conquered more land for themselves. That's what this northern tribe is up here. So this city of Dan. In the New Testament, this becomes the city of Caesarea Philippi, which we've just referenced in our series on Matthew. This peak right here, just north of Dan, is Mount Hermon. It's a very tall mountain, some 9,000 feet in elevation. It's a very high mountain. It's probably the mountain where the transfiguration took place of Jesus, but it's a pretty important city. Right up here, if you go to the city of Dan and just go a few miles to the northwest, up here in the hill country, you come into Abel Beth Maacah, the city where Sheba flees to. So he is obviously on a trajectory to leave the country. And I think there's a reason for that. Tim, question.
I'm looking at my map in my Bible here. I do not have that city on it.
No, it's not listed. It actually took me a long time to find it. And I have this fun computer program that searches everything for me. If I typed in Abel, doesn't find anything. I type in Abel Beth Maacah, it doesn't find anything. It took me a long time to find out where this city's at. I had to go to a couple commentaries that said, well, this city's also known as, and oh, there it is. So that's how I found it. But it is right about here, extreme northern part of Israel. So what do you think Sheba's doing? I think he's fleeing the country, yeah. He realizes nobody's following him. Because who's he got with him? Just his family. But nobody else has come alongside him. Nobody else has followed him. They all dispersed when he blew the trumpet. But their discontentment, their disgruntlement, didn't translate into full rebellion the way he'd hoped. And so I think as he's passing through all the tribes of Israel on his way north, he's planning on just getting out of Israel because he realizes what this means. He's committed high treason, and the punishment for that is
death.
Yep. So he goes to Abel Beth Maacah, and all the Bechorites assembled and followed him. Verse 15, all the men who were with Joab came and besieged him in Abel of Beth Maacah. They cast up a mound against the city, and it stood against the rampart, and they were battering the wall to throw it down. Interesting phrasing there, literally says, and they were destroying to throw down the wall. Very picturesque way. So you can just imagine as Joab comes to this city and they lock all the gates, they bar up all the doors, and they post their guards on top of the city wall. Everybody that lives outside the city comes inside. I mean, you just gather everything in a siege. And so there's Joab and his men. They surround the city. And at one point where they decide it's the weakest, they will start advancing by slow degrees. And there's a ditch in front of the city because he says there that they cast up a mound against the city and it stood against the rampart. That rampart is another word for a moat, right? And so there was a ditch around this city. And you would dig a ditch around the city so that when any intruders got close, they were obviously much farther down. That makes it harder for them to shoot their arrows up or to attack your men on the wall, and it makes it easier for you to shoot down on them because obviously things going down pick up speed, so your arrows have more effect. Or you can throw rocks upon them or whatever, but being farther down makes it harder to attack upwards. And so here's this moat that they have, but Joab is slowly filling it in to grant himself an access to the wall. And when they fill it in enough and get up to the wall, then they're attacking the wall with their instruments of war, trying to knock the wall down. Now we know that a lot of times Archaeologists like to picture this period of history as almost Stone Age. In fact, we're right on the border of what archaeologists call the Bronze Age and the Iron Age. Okay, and remember, that's an archaeological distinction. We can show from Scripture that people were using iron tools long before what archaeology says is the Iron Age. The Iron Age begins about 1200 BC, archaeologically speaking. And so that's the time when they say we kind of learned how to stop using bronze tools and we started being able to smelt iron, make steel, things like that. But in the book of Job, Job makes an interesting statement about engraving his complaints with an iron pen. And most scholars recognize that Job is probably the oldest book we have in the Bible. And so even Job, who's probably writing 21, 2200 BC, is talking about iron instruments. Now, what's the first reference to bronze and iron instruments in the Scripture? Genesis where? Tubal-Cain. Yeah. Tubal-Cain, way back in Genesis chapter 4. You're talking four generations after Adam, we started figuring out how to mold metals into the shapes we wanted. In fact, it wasn't just like making an iron bar that you could club things with either, because what did Tubal-Cain make? Instruments. Okay, so how delicate do you have to be with your metalworking to make musical instruments? Okay, yeah, Dan's not here tonight, but we could ask him how hard it is to actually make a guitar. And that's just wood. It takes a lot of delicate skill and finesse. And so mankind very, very early on learned how to make iron instruments. Well, in reference to what's going on here in this siege of the city, we know that they knew how to make pretty impressive instruments of war. In just a few chapters, we're going to run into a description. Now, it is about 200 years later, but we're going to run into some descriptions of instruments that Jehoshaphat puts on the towers of Jerusalem, it says, to sling great stones. And so up on the towers of Jerusalem, they're putting catapults and trebuchets and things that can hurl rocks at invaders in order. It's like mountain cannons on top of the towers. So their technology is a lot farther along than a lot of people think. And so Joab surrounds this city, would have began constructing his siege instruments that were designed to breach the city walls. So you can imagine battering rams. You can imagine towers that they would put on wheels to roll up against the city wall, and then your men could go up a little staircase and get onto the wall. But the whole point is, breach that wall, breach that defense, and get into the city. This is what Joab's doing. And he's being very vehement about it, with that phrasing, they're trying to throw down the wall and destroy it. So here's the picture of this violent siege. Sometimes they would dig tunnels under the walls in an attempt to destabilize them. And so if you could get access, you'd dig this long tunnel. You know, you'd have to start away from the archers, because if you're within range of the archers and you start digging, unless you're really quick with your shovel, you know, you can deflect all these arrows and still dig. You'd have to be pretty good for that. But they would start way, way, way back from the wall, and they would dig this tunnel under, and you try to hollow out underneath the wall, because obviously a city wall is heavy. That's a lot of stone stacked up there, and so if there's nothing holding it up, you can make the wall collapse or make one of the towers fall down, and that gives you entrance to the city. Well, they had lots of ways that they could try to do this. here's an interesting story. In the Civil War, one of the cities that the North was besieging in the South, they did this under General McClellan, and they dug several hundred yards underground, emptied out a big hole, and filled it with dynamite, and then blew it up. But it backfired on them because the rebels found out about it, and they evacuated their camp. So when the North blew up this huge thing, they just left a crater in the earth that's now an obstacle in their way to get to where the rebels are. And so they tried to charge across it, and it just became this great killing field because you got all your northern soldiers going down into this crater to try and cross it, and they're just getting slaughtered. So it didn't work. But anyway, that's neither here nor there. That is a classic example of history nerd in action, right? So, all right, here's where the things really start getting interesting. Verse 16, then a wise woman called from the city, listen, listen! Why does she say it twice? important, or maybe because all the battering rams are making so much noise, you got to quiet everybody down, right? But no, repetition in the Old Testament especially, and even in the New Testament, repetition increases the intensity. Listen, listen, this is something important. So she's calling out to the wall, listen, tell Joab, come here that I may speak to you. So this woman leans out one of the windows of the wall, or leans out over the wall, and says, I want to talk to Joab. This is an official invitation to a parley. And this happens even in modern times. We'll call a ceasefire for a little bit so that the two opposing generals can talk and see if they can work out the difference without having to kill anybody else, right? And so she's calling out and saying, bring Joab here. Let's call a ceasefire for just a few minutes and see if we can figure this whole thing out without having to kill a whole bunch of people. And here's what she's got to say, verse 17. He came near, and the woman said, are you Joab? And he answered, I am. Then she said to him, listen to the words of your servant. And he answered, I'm listening. Then she said, they used to say in former times, let them but ask counsel at Abel. And so they settled the matter. So what is she saying? That don't kill everybody. This is an important town. This town is central to the area because they used to say, just come here and you can have your disputes settled peacefully. We're a city that tries to settle disputes peacefully and you're trying to destroy us. So that's her number one objection. So she's trying to convince him to stop this battle. And so, hey, we're a well-respected city, so why destroy us? Verse 18, I am one of those who are peaceable and faithful in Israel. Peaceable, obviously, referencing, we don't want to cause strife. What does she mean by faithful? I follow, who do you think she means? I don't think she's referencing probably because he's the one that appointed the king, but more specific, we're faithful. We follow King David. We're not a rebellious city. Why else would you try to be destroying a city unless they were a rebellious city? But we're peaceful. We're faithful in Israel. We don't want a rebellion, and we're faithful. We follow David, so why are you trying to destroy us? I'm one of those who are peaceful and faithful in Israel. You seek to destroy a city that is a mother in Israel. Why would you swallow up the heritage of the Lord? Now, does anybody else find that question interesting? Why is Joab attacking the city? Well, Amasa's dead. He wants Sheba, right? Yeah. Amasa's dead. He wants Sheba. So why is this question such an interesting one? Why will you destroy the city? Tim? Well, I think Joab's trying to look good in front of David by bringing in this rebel. Yep. But do you see, she doesn't know why they're being attacked. Joab's brought up this army and they bolted up the city when they realized he was going to attack, and now they're trying to destroy the city, but this woman sticks her head out and says, what are you doing? Why are you trying to kill us? I think Joab, in his rage and his vehemence to try and get this rebel, didn't even notify the city of what's going on. It's just the guy shut himself in there, let's go get him. Now, whatever happened, so when Sheba gets to the city, we don't even have any indication that anybody knew he was there. Because this woman is putting her head out the window saying, why are you trying to destroy the city? What's going on? We don't even understand why we're being attacked. And so she's trying to convince Joab that he's unjustly attacking the city, which he is. Deuteronomy chapter 20, verse 10. God commanded the armies of Israel that when you're going to besiege a city, the first thing you have to do is offer terms of peace. You realize God had built into the law rules against scorched warfare policy? Scorched earth policy. You know, that's that idea that when you come in to attack a land, you destroy everything so that they'll never again be able to raise up against you. God said, don't do that. If you don't have to, don't destroy the city. So when you get there, offer terms of peace to them, and if they'll submit to you, then make them forced laborers. But don't destroy them all. He also commanded, don't cut down all the trees to make, you know, just enough to make your siege works, but don't destroy everything that's around the city. Don't destroy the fields that are around it. You're going to want those to be productive again. You're going to want those trees there. So God had built into the law rules against scorched earth warfare. And Joab was ignoring that. He didn't even tell the city why they were being attacked. He just, oh, let's destroy it. Kind of the jump in without asking any questions, or jump first and ask questions later mentality. I know none of us struggle with that problem, do we? Well, so this woman is putting out many of these arguments to try and stop this. So first, she's very humble in her entreaties, and she says, listen to your servant. That's a very submissive tone to take with Joab, which helps build her argument. We're a well-respected city, so why would you want to destroy us? The city's peaceful and faithful, so we're a submissive city, so you shouldn't destroy us. We're a prosperous city. She says we're a mother in Israel, meaning that was an important city to the economy of the locale. But she also says we're confused. We don't even know why you're here attacking us. Why would you destroy the heritage of the Lord? And so Joab has to reply here. In verse 20, far be it from me, far be it. You notice the double rendition again? So, far be it from me, far be it that I should swallow up or destroy. Now I want you to think about that comment from Joab for just a moment. How far is it from Joab to swallow up or destroy? Yeah, it's probably not more than half a step sideways, right? Joab is not the kind of guy that you would trust to not destroy things. Obviously, he's murdered three people, at least. He had no problem with David murdering Uriah, just went ahead and did it, even though he knew what was going on, right? So, and he's also just destroying the city without offering the terms of peace that God required. So he's very deluded about his own scruples. Far be it for me, far be it that I should swallow up or destroy. And we even have that testimony back when the soldier came to him and said, I found Absalom hanging in a tree over there. And Joab says, ah, you should have killed him and I would have paid you money. And the guy says, if I'd have killed him and David found out about it, you'd be the first one to accuse me. So people recognized what Joab was like. He was strong. He was a very strong leader, very strong military commander, got the job done, but he wasn't the most upstanding guy, and everybody knew it. And so he's a little deluded about his own scruples and character there. That is not true, verse 21. This is not true. I'm not trying to destroy the city, but finally we're going to get around to the reason. A man of the hill country of Ephraim called Sheba, the son of Bichri, has lifted up his hand against King David. Give up him alone, and I will withdraw from the city. Here's your terms of peace. Here's what you should have given at the beginning, Joab. But now they have all these holes to repair in the wall, and this moat to dig back out, and all these trees to replant from the siege engines that you've built. So you should have said this at the beginning, but here's the terms of peace. I want Sheba, and that's it. I just want this one guy. So now the city knows there's a rebel in our midst. He's coming here with his family, and so what are we going to do about it? And this is all that they want. Now, you have Joab's testimony about the rebellion. We're not told about any of the other proceedings that go on here. So we just kind of have to hope that they went about this lawfully, what they're going to do. All right. And the woman said to Joab, behold, his head shall be thrown to you over the wall. Again, not a very American kind of thing to do. We tend to not treat our defeated people this brutally, or we try not to. That's not saying we've always done everything right. And so sometimes this offends our sensibilities, but it was pretty standard practice. Rebels don't get treated with too much mercy under ancient traditions. Okay? So the woman went to all the people in her wisdom, and they cut off the head of Sheba, the son of Bichri, and threw it out to Joab. So we can only assume that they went about this lawfully, and hopefully followed God's principles of judgment in obtaining an execution order against him. But they at least had Joab's testimony. Probably wouldn't have been too hard to find other people's testimony. Yeah, I was there when Sheba blew the trumpet. Here's what he said. Here's what he did. Okay, you have his family there with him. Hopefully you could get some corroboration out of that. But whatever the process, she goes to them in her wisdom, and she's described as this wise woman twice. Because she can see the danger that's imminent in the city, and she's the one that goes out and figures out how to fix it and how to save the city. Okay? And so she does. And she convinces the men of the city to deliver Sheba over. They cut off his head, throw it over the wall. Yuck. But there it is. So Joab blew the trumpet, and they dispersed from the city, every man to his home. Mission's over. We've got his head. That's a pretty good guarantee that he's not going to rise up in rebellion again, at least not anytime soon. That takes a while to recover from in most instances, doesn't it? Having your head removed. And so he can take this prize of war back to David to say the rebellion has been squelched. It's been completely stopped. Because the only people following Sheba were his own family. Nobody else rose up like he thought they were going to. And so it's over. So Joab returned to Jerusalem to the king, brings this present. How many of you are just dying to get somebody's head for Christmas? Wouldn't that be fun? All right. And so that is the end of Sheba's rebellion. David has squelched it. Or I should say Joab has squelched it. So here we do see Joab's not the most upstanding guy, but he is used by the Lord in some pretty astounding ways to ensure that David's kingdom is safe. And that's not, I think, an excuse to allow violent men to do whatever they want to do. But Joab is used by the Lord in some pretty amazing ways to make sure that David's kingdom continues here. And that's what verses 23 through 26 give us. They are descriptions of David's officers. But the reason this list is here is to show us that David's kingdom has been reestablished in its authority because David was able to reconstitute his government. So we have Joab in command of all the army of Israel. This is the way it has been for quite some time. Joab himself is probably getting to be an older man now because he's been with David since the beginning. And as we've said, we're getting towards the end of David's life. David's probably now in his early to mid-60s. He's only going to live to 70. And so we're getting close to the end of David's reign. That means Joab, if he was commander of the army when David became king at 30, then Joab probably had to be close to that age as well. So Joab's not a spring chicken anymore either. But he's managed to maintain his position as chief of the army all throughout David's rule. And so here he is again as the commander of the army. He's not the best guy, morally speaking, but he's safe. At least, shouldn't say safe. He's a known entity. We'll do it that way, right? David at least knows him. And so Joab's in command of the army of Israel. Benaiah, the son of Jehoiada, was in command of the Kerethites and the Pelethites. So there are two lists that were given of David's officers. The first of them is in 2 Samuel chapter 8. Verses 15 to 18. And that follows the section that described David's wanderings from Saul and his initial battles with the Philistines and with the Edomites and with the Syrians. And at the end of that section of warfare, we have a list of David's officers. Again, why is that put there? Because it shows that David's kingdom was secured. He was able to order his government in a very organized way because the wars were over. War causes some pretty horrible disorganization. It depletes the resources of a nation. It depletes the people. People get tired of war, even if they're winning it. And so you have to have, even though there is sometimes a necessity of war, it can't go on forever. It's got to stop, and life has to come back to normal for a little while, right? So in each of those lists, there are some similarities, and there are a couple of differences. The first similarity is that Joab's over the army in both of them. Benaiah is the commander of the Kelethites and the Pelethites. Now, we've mentioned them before. They are probably something like David's personal bodyguard. This would have been a group of his most trusted men. They went with him into exile. when Absalom rebelled, and they're still with him. And so we have the same person in command of them at the beginning of David's reign as here at the end. The next guy that's mentioned is Adoram, and he's in charge of the forced labor. So all the places David went and he conquered his enemies, one of the aspects of tribute, there were taxes that would have to be paid. But one of the aspects of tribute was, you're going to send men in for my construction projects. And you have a quota of men that I want you to fulfill every year. And by the way, you're paying for them, right? So you send them in, my guy will manage them. That's how you get roads built. That's how you get palaces built. That's how you get the temple built, is with this labor, tributary labor. And so David, at this point, has a man, Adoram, over tributary labor. Now, here's the interesting part. Adoram is the one guy not mentioned in the earlier list. After David's initial victories over Philistia and Edom and Syria, he's the one guy not mentioned. But he's mentioned here. So we are, we're 25 years later. David's had time to organize his government to such a degree now that he's involved in a lot more building projects. And one of the things that we're going to find out he's working on is, anybody know? He's gathering material for the temple. That takes a lot of hands. And so David is doing the preparatory work, so he has this man in charge of tributary labor. Next person on the list, Jehoshaphat, the son of Ahilud, was the recorder. That's something like the official court historian. So if you want to get to sleep at night, you ask Jehoshaphat to come to you and read the minutes of your courtroom meetings, right? So Jehoshaphat is the recorder. Sheva was the secretary, and Zadok and Abiathar were priests. So there's a little change there, because it used to be Zadok and Abimelech. Zadok and Abimelech. But there's these two guys are serving co-jointly as the chief priest at this time. That's going to change under Solomon, because they're going to get back to the biblical requirement of one chief priest. And Solomon's going to ensure that when the temple's built. Ira the Jerite was also David's priest. Now, in that instance, we've got a little bit of a different wording that shows us this guy's not functioning as a personal priest. It's more like a really close counselor. Okay. The change in this list was that previously it said David's sons served as these guys. David's sons served as his close counselors. Why do you think that might have changed? Well, he's already lost one, two, actually. Right? Yep, and there is, actually. There's going to be a little bit of jealousy between David's sons here. But at any rate, David has kind of pushed his sons out of this counselor's role, probably because of what happened with Absalom and all of the trouble that was caused there. But these few verses show us that David's kingdom is settled again. He's had some time now to put back the pieces after Absalom's rebellion. The first part of David's reign is an uphill climb. It's all success. It's battles, it's fights, it's struggles, but it's all successful. And it's David pursuing God's course for his life in a very devout, faithful way. The second half of David's life is a decline, as he pursues his own way, because he's hit that peak of power. He feels like he can do whatever he wants, but then he starts to decline because he abandons God's path for him. He starts setting aside God's rule for his life. And in the matter of Bathsheba, and the matter of Uriah, in the raising of his sons, and in handling Joab even, in many of those ways, David stepped aside from God's prescribed way, from God's law for him. And it's a visible illustration of what happens to us when we don't do things God's way. Because how did it go for David in the second half of his life? Not so well, huh? Okay. The Old Testament, especially these historical books, are for us living illustrations of God's word. How does God deal with us? Well, the way he deals with David. Right? How does God deal with us? The way he deals with Solomon. Are there some differences because of the dispensation in which we live? Yes. But the character that you see in God and the way he handles his people very often is the same. And so when we see God's people obeying God and things going the way they're supposed to, there's a lesson in that. There's an illustration there. When you see God's people deviating from God's plan and horrible consequences befalling it, that's a lesson for us. That's an illustration for us. And the New Testament takes up that for us and tells us that they are living examples, living illustrations for us in putting God's word into practice. And so, as we continue on through David's life here, he's got a few more struggles to overcome before the end. Eventually, we know he's going to be dubbed as a man after God's own heart. Despite his failures, this is a faithful guy. He loves God. He wants to do what's right. But isn't that a great example for us that God doesn't abandon us when we do it wrong? He'll allow us to suffer some of the consequences so that we learn. He'll discipline us as a father disciplines his sons, but he never, never abandons us. So all the effects of God's covenant with David in 2 Samuel 17, the Davidic covenant, right? Sorry, 2 Samuel 7, I'll establish your throne forever. God is fulfilling those things. Does that promise apply to you? There's a caveat in that, though, isn't there? How does the promise apply to us? Only through Christ. I'm not one of David's sons, but in Christ I actually am. The promise of the kingdom is mine. Any questions? That wraps up.